Welcome to Pound the Rock, the Scores NBA podcast. My name is Joseph Cacciaro, and I'm joined, as always, by co-host Joe Wolfond.
What up, Cash? We're here, man. Let's fucking go.
We are on the precipice of the playoffs. We're here. And there's a lot to talk about today, both with respect to the playoffs themselves, some injuries that have popped up. In addition to the injuries we already talked about last week, we had an NBA player banned for life this week. Like, there's a lot to talk about in addition to digging in to the six playoff series that are already set, which I think we're going to do in the second half of the show. So before we get to that, let's spend the first half of the show going through some of this news. Jonte Porter being banned for life, some of the injuries that popped up. I feel like we should probably get Jonte out of the way. I feel like we both have some thoughts on it. I mean, I think before we get into this, let me just say I'm aware that there will be some people rolling their eyes listening to us talk about this, because the Score does have a betting app that is very visible in Ontario, if that's where you're listening from. And Penn is a gaming company as much as it's an entertainment company. But yeah, like, I'm not here to lecture anyone on how they feel about sports betting in general, but there are some things I feel like we do need to point out in terms of some of the reactions we've seen to this saga. Agree?
Yeah, I mean, I'm like personally a little bit uncomfortable with the extent of these leagues' partnerships with gambling companies and the extent to which those partnerships are pushed. So I don't want to shunt any of that aside at all, but I just don't think that it actually has that much to do with Jonte Porter and what he did. Like, I think you can recognize that there is an uncomfortable dynamic there without reading any causality into this particular situation. So, I mean, I'll just, like, I think the NBA absolutely had to do this.
Yeah.
And I think that Jonte Porter was a complete idiot.
Yeah.
For doing this in the first place, and, like, for doing it as sloppily and obviously as he did it. And he is obviously paying the price for that.
Jonte Porter wasn't banned for life for merely gambling on sports, or even for simply gambling on basketball. He was banned for life for knowingly breaking the most cardinal rule, like knowingly committing the most cardinal sin when it comes to sports, games, competitive leagues, etc. He compromised the very integrity of the game itself in what was essentially akin to match fixing or prop fixing, if you will. And no matter the excuse, no matter a player's track record, whatever, that deserves a lifetime ban in any competitive league anywhere on earth. The fact that the NBA is now in bed with gaming companies and promotes in-game betting is irrelevant to this specific issue. Again, given that some people will believe we're professionally biased here, like, I won't even get into how people feel about sports leagues being involved in that or not. Like, feel however you want about that. Though I will say, in general, with matters like these, I'm for regulation. Don't forget, what are still the biggest betting scandals in North American sports history occurred when it was illegal and leagues stayed as far away as they could from it. Black Sox scandal, Boston College scandal, Tim Donaghy, etc. But anyway, again, back to the point. There are plenty of situations in life where, for various reasons, whether that be conflict of interest issues, integrity issues, whatever, certain people or employees can't do certain things that others can. Heck, literally us, we can't wager on the score betting app. Makes sense. And in the case of the NBA, no shit, players can't bet on the league despite the fact that the league encourages fans to. Like, it's not rocket science. Jonte Porter making the moronic decision he did is a Jonte Porter issue, not an NBA issue, and he was rightly punished like so. Like, is it sad that a guy who had battled back from injury-related adversity early in his career and had possibly put himself in position to earn a contract worth, you know, roughly $2 million next year, threw it all away to profit, what, I think it ended up being like $20,000 or something? Yeah, of course that's sad. And I'm not going to speculate like others have about whether he actually has a problem or if he's just a fool, whatever. But either way, even if one of those scenarios means he should get access to help, it also still means he should never be allowed to play in the NBA again, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, I think I've seen people make the point where it's like, oh, it's easy to make an example of this guy who's like an end-of-the-bench type of player, which, like, of course it is. Like, if this was LeBron James, it would have been a more difficult decision for the NBA, and maybe the punishment wouldn't have been as definitive. that's just the reality, right? Like, it's...
I'm going to be honest, man. I know people won't believe this, and there's no way for us to prove it. I think he would have been... I think it would have been obviously a much bigger scandal and insane, yeah, and, like, everyone would have been losing their shit. I think he would have been banned for life. You can't, like...
Would have taken a 2-year sabbatical to play baseball and then come back.
Fair enough. Fair enough. The point is, he would not have been involved with the NBA if he was match fixing, man.
Again, I don't want to disregard the concerns that people have about the encroachment of betting into the way that we consume professional sports, like the nonstop advertisements, the segments of, you know, experts talking about betting lines and props every single game, the way that this stuff is just blared into our eyeballs over and over and over again. I've said it many times before, like, I don't bet on sports, but it is, and whether like Jonte Porter is a gambling addict or not, it's like, I think we can understand that this stuff is not, it's not something to be trifled with, man. Like, again, it can be a life ruining addiction. So I'm sensitive to that, but I just think that this has nothing really to do with that. So, and another thing, I know we talked about this a little bit offline, but I think there are a lot of people who have called out the fact that you don't see a punishment nearly this severe for, say, like domestic abusers in the NBA. And I think it's fine to say like the NBA needs a better DV policy. That's something that has to be negotiated with the Players Association. And like, again, I can say for me personally, I don't want to see Miles Bridges playing in the NBA. Course. But when it comes to what is within the NBA's kind of authority and purview, I think you should also be able to recognize that this is like a lot more clear cut, mm-hmm, in the way that it impacts like the integrity of the league and potentially impacts the league's bottom line. And also just in terms of, again, like dealing with the Players Association and what that would mean when something like domestic violence is like, this is a sad reality, but it's like, it's harder to hold up in a court of law. And then when it comes to what the NBA should do about that, it's going to be a lot more complicated when it comes to negotiating with the Players Association about what can be done when all there really is to go on is, I mean, like, there are facts and investigations that can be done, of course, but is the Players Association going to agree to stipulations where when somebody isn't formally convicted, then can they still be banned for life by the NBA? You know what I mean? So it's easy for us to say like, yeah, like we've seen the facts in the Miles Bridges case. Like, we know about the facts in the Derrick Rose case, and we can say those players should be out of the league. They should be pariahs. But I think that's a lot more difficult for the NBA to make a decision like that than it is for them to deal with a player who has been proven to have been compromising the integrity of the games themselves.
Yeah, that's well said. Despite what some people seem to be saying or pretend to think, this is not the NBA saying that what Jonte Porter did makes him a worse person than alleged abusers, okay? Like, those are obviously heinous crimes that are obviously much more severe, damaging, traumatic in the grand scheme of life. And no one is suggesting otherwise. But as you said, like, there are certain legal processes that the NBA first has to wait to play out in those situations, and then has to deal with the Players Association, which, like, that's just not, we're not going to get to a place where the Players Association, the union, is okay with players being banned for allegations that oftentimes, again, as you noted, like, don't hold up in court. And that is unfortunate. But in this case, like, something can be obviously less severe in the grand scheme of life while still being more pertinent when it comes to the NBA's and the commissioner's purview and power. And when it comes to that power, when it comes to like specifically things that can happen within the sports world and things related to the games themselves, there is no offense more serious that one can commit than what Jonte Porter did.
Yeah.
And I feel like we can leave that there.
I'm happy to leave that there. Let's talk about actual basketball, please. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's do that with a team that won't be playing actual basketball until October. Because, Wolfon, you came through with a predictably excellent postmortem of this year's Warriors. Almost a postmortem of the dynasty and this core as a whole, in which you asked, is it time for the Warriors to let go? And that is the question to ask, right? Because with Klay hitting free agency. I mean, you've got Steph Curry, Draymond Green, Steve Kerr, all kind of pleading in their own way for Klay to be back. So let's talk about it. Not just whether Klay will be back, but what you wrote about the Warriors, your thoughts on the end of this team and potentially the end of this run.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't like really come down on it definitively one way or another, because I think even if they do decide, okay, it's time to move on from Klay, for example, but we'll keep Steph, we'll keep Draymond, we'll roll this thing back in some moderated fashion and see how far we can push it. As long as Steph is in, I mean, he's in the twilight of his prime right now, but like he's still playing at a borderline all-NBA level. And I think there is, I don't think the Warriors are ever going to trade Steph Curry, right? And especially not while he's still playing at this level. Yeah. So I think that is, it's not even worth like pondering that possibility, because I just think it's not going to happen. I think whether they bring Klay back or whether they try to sort of like tweak the roster around Steph and Draymond and like now Kuminga and Trayce Jackson-Davis and like Pajemski, like some, they had meaningful growth from some of their young players this year that I don't want to like skate past. But I just don't know that like there is like inner circle contention in their near future one way or another. And I think we can say that that's been clear for most of this season. That's why I was saying like, yes, there is an air of finality to it because of the way that they got demolished by the Kings team that they beat in the playoffs last year in a game that this year left them short of the playoffs proper. Like that makes it seem like, okay, now we can finally shovel dirt on them and say this dynasty is dead. Even if I remember talking about this, you know, midway through the season, where we're like, yeah, this is the life cycle of contending teams. You know, like the Spurs are the great exception because they traded George Hill for Kawhi Leonard on draft night. And Kawhi Leonard, even, you know, as a 15th pick in the draft, is like a needle in a haystack. And that is like a once in a generation type of trade that like prolonged that dynasty. And even for the Warriors, man, like their 2022 title is still an outlier. For like they have prolonged their contending cycle for like far beyond what most teams are able to do as it is. So, I, you know, like this is sad, but it's expected, right? Like Steph Curry is 36 and Klay is 34. Like they're, and with like two major, major lower body injuries in the rear view, like it's just kind of inevitable. So as far as what they should do, it's kind of just like, to me, comes down to sentimentality. And I don't mean to say that in a pejorative way. You know what I mean? Like if they decide that they don't see like the next 2 years leading to a championship anyway, and they're like, for us, it's worth it just to bring Klay back and let these guys kind of have two more kicks at the can, like see how good we can be, like see how can internal development for some of these young guys and maybe Draymond figuring out how to control his impulses to the point that he doesn't get suspended next year. Can we come back and win 50 games and win a playoff series? And is that enough for us, given what these three guys have been through together, to give them another couple years rather than blowing it up now? Not blowing it up, but rather than moving on now. So I think there are cases to be made for either direction. Like I think Chris Paul, who's got a $30 million non-guaranteed deal for next year, like I think they're not going to want to have that $30 million on their books. Now, whether they kind of waive that non-guarantee or whether they say like try to trade him before his guarantee date to like bring a couple more pieces in the door.
That date, by the way, is June 28th for anyone that doesn't know.
Right. So I mean, they're not going to have their draft pick this year. But again, they got like they had two major hits late in the draft in Pajemski, who went, what, 21st overall, I want to say, and Trayce Jackson-Davis, who went in the second round. Like that's a big deal. But the notion or the fanciful idea that they once may have had of like seamlessly bridging this era of contention to the next one is pretty much out the window, right? Like the young contingent didn't get good enough fast enough to bridge that divide. And now, like, the older contingent is, like, too old, I think, and, like, too far gone to have those two timelines sort of link up in the way that they once might have imagined. I think the Wiseman pick is sort of the flashpoint there. Like, that was their one opportunity, I think, to really do that. And it obviously didn't work out for them. And then you had the Jordan Poole thing, right? Where Poole looked for a minute like maybe the guy who was going to be able to bridge that divide. And that went the way that it did. Wiggins, like, he's not really young, but he's not old either. He's like kind of in the sweet spot where he might have helped be part of that bridge. And, you know, obviously he's had those personal absences that I don't want to speculate about. Whatever the reason, his game fell off a cliff. And that was hugely damaging, like hugely damaging to this team this year. Like the fact that they just could not rely on Wiggins at either end of the floor. Like, you know, we talk a lot about the teams that do all this lineup juggling. I don't think any team did more lineup juggling than the Warriors did this season. And how so often that is just a result of a team not having enough two-way players and having to juggle these lineups because they can't figure out the right balance of offense and defense. And I feel like that was the Warriors this year. And Wiggins was like supposed to be that reliable two-way wing for them who at various points this season was like a zero-way player, like not bringing it at either end of the floor. So it's just like you could talk yourself into these things bouncing back, like Wiggins bouncing back, like Draymond not getting suspended, like whatever it is, like you can internal development, you can talk yourself into all these things going right next year and the team still being competitive. But the West is daunting and it's not getting any easier next year with like Memphis is going to rejoin the fray and who knows what kind of move San Antonio is going to make to maybe try to expedite its timeline. Utah, Houston, like it's not getting any easier. So I just think regardless of what the Warriors decide to do, whether they decide it's time to move on from Klay, whether, you know, they think about potentially moving on from Draymond, whether they try to like maybe package some of their young talent in order to bring in a veteran who can help them in the present day, whatever it is, I don't see it leading to like meaningful contention in the next little while. So I think that's why I kind of came down on this decision is just about like, you know, how long do they want to hold on to this? Hold on to something that means a ton to them, but is no longer going to help them win anything of consequence.
I get that for the people running the team and for the fans, like they're not going to want to hear this because obviously they should always be trying to win. But if you just look at like the big picture, them kind of cycling out of that window and maybe now being on the downturn, like in the big picture is okay based on the way things go. Like if you go back to the first time they made the playoffs in the Steph era, this is now the 12th season since then. This is the 10th season since their first title with this core in 2014-15. Again, I'm not suggesting the Warriors just throw their hands up and be like, we're good. We don't need to try. But this is a run that most franchises, fan base will literally never live to see. And so while I understand why they want to try to keep extending the window and why they will try to at least remain competitive for as long as Steph Curry's there and all those things, you also have to accept reality in that, like, it wasn't going to go on forever. It already lasted a lot longer than most teams ever get in terms of, like, a competitive window. And, like, things are just happening now. It's not going to last any longer. And, like, this is their new normal. It's, like, hoping things break right and they can get in the playoffs. And then it's like, okay, well, then maybe if we just get in the tournament, you know, we got a shot with this veteran know-how. But you know, their days of like dominating and being a no-brainer contender are over because that's just what happens as players age out, as players move on, as players get suspended six times a year. Like all that stuff adds up. The one guy, if you look at that 2022 championship, like the one guy, if you think of like homegrown youngsters that really could have represented the whole two timelines thing was Jordan Poole. And he turned into a pumpkin the next year. And again, obviously, a lot of people will understandably say it started with that Draymond punch. Whatever. He turned into a pumpkin after that. He was never the same. And the Warriors, other youngsters from that time, obviously James Wiseman, like that didn't work out. Now they've got this new crop of youngsters that are really good. But I don't know if anyone's like out there realistically thinking that this very good crop of Warriors youngster, is it going to like propel them to contention again anytime soon? Like, that's not happening. So I don't have any arguments with what you said, but I think my question would be at this point, and maybe the biggest question is, can Steph himself still lift the tide enough? Like, I think even if you just go by how he was this year, like, he's still like a top 10-ish game-breaking star. Like, his shooting and his gravity are still that impactful. And again, obviously, like, the Warriors owe it to him to keep trying to compete as long as he's around. But I do think it's worth asking how much longer he can even be the type of star you can compete with. You know, the Warriors, they have most of their picks. I think they've got two that they've traded, but they've got the rest of them. They've got these young guys kind of popping now. But again, it's like, at this stage of Steph's career and where they are in their competitive window, I don't think they want to be mortgaging too much of their future to try to sustain this. Like, it's a tough balancing act, right? Where it's like, you want to keep giving this guy the chance to compete, but he's also at a point in his career now where you can't justify mortgaging the future the way you could even say 2 years ago.
Yeah, so I think that he is definitely still good enough to be the best player on like a competitive team, a contending team even. But if you think back to that 2022 season, like even that version of Andrew Wiggins, who was the second best player probably on that Warriors team, I know he was an all-star starter that year, but I don't think that that actually speaks to the quality of player that he was. Like that was a huge gulf from Steph to the next best player on that team. And that is atypical for a championship winner. Like that version of Steph, I don't think is coming back, that can carry a team where the secondary top end talent is like that underwhelming. And then if you look at the team this year, like that gap was even more stark with Wiggins cratering the way that he did, Klay struggling to the point that he was relegated to the bench at one point. And honestly, had kind of turned his season around before having that stinker in the play-in game where he shot 0 for 10 from the field, 0 for 6 from deep. Not the way that you want to see his, potentially his Golden State Warriors career end. You know, the silver lining maybe being that those stats don't actually count anywhere. So hopefully for Klay's sake, that 0 for 10 just gets washed away and becomes lost to history. But like the Kings in that game just through like relentless ball pressure at Steph. Two on the ball, like getting into him, like face guarding him off the ball, and nobody could pick up the slack. You know, whether it was Klay shooting 0 for 10, whether it was Wiggins, I think Wiggins was like 4 for 11, couldn't make much of an impact on the game. Like honestly, Moses Moody was like the only guy who was giving them any kind of consistent offensive production, and he played like 15 minutes. So I just think, to your question about can Steph be the guy who's like the rising tide that lifts all boats at this point, I think he still can, but I think there's obviously a limit to that. And I think if, especially at his age now, if he's going to do that and continue being the guy who, like, I think he is still capable of being sort of an offensive system unto himself. Because the Warriors, even with this sort of talent deficit or secondary talent deficit, were like a top 10 offense this year because of Steph's gravity, what he can do on and obviously off the ball. And if they put like more surrounding talent around him, then yeah, I think he can still be the best player on a competitive team, maybe even a contending team in the right circumstances. But with this particular group, that's pretty difficult to imagine. And I mean, this was like, he played 74 games this year, right?
Yep.
And they still wound up where they wound up. So that's kind of my thought. It's like 36-year-old Steph Curry, still a wonderful, wonderful player, but not going to be the guy who drags a team like the, you know, 2022 iteration of this team to a championship. So they either have to find a way to put more talent around him, or they have to sort of pick a different path where maybe they're taking a longer view.
Yeah. Okay. Now to some teams that can still take the kind of shorter view because they're still alive, but they are clinging to fading hopes due to some injuries. Giannis Antetokounmpo, doubtful for the start of Bucks Pacers with a calf strain. Kawhi Leonard's knee is structurally sound, but that twice surgically repaired knee still can't shake all that inflammation. So his status is up in the air. Jimmy Butler finished Miami's play-in loss to the Sixers with an MCL injury that could keep him out weeks and definitely seems like it'll keep him out of the final play-in rematch against Kobe White's Bulls. Shout out Kobe White, man. And then there's a Zion injury. Jesus, that we can talk about, and I have many thoughts about. I wrote about this week. So let's save Zion for the end of this conversation, but those first few I mentioned, Giannis, who we've already kind of talked about, Jimmy Butler, Kawhi, is there one that you're like, okay, this is the one we need to talk about in terms of like how I see the playoffs potentially playing out?
No, there's not one in particular because all these teams are cooked if these guys aren't making it back. The Pelicans, I think, could conceivably beat the Kings in a one-game play-in at home without Zion, but have no hope of making it through the Thunder without him. So they're cooked. The Clippers are cooked if Kawhi can't make it back or is like making it back at like, you know, 60% or whatever it is. Same thing goes for the Bucks. Obviously the Heat, again, could the Heat beat the Bulls in a one-game play-in to get the eighth seed? Sure. Are they going to do anything against the Celtics without Jimmy Butler? Obviously not. So, yeah, I don't think there's any one where I'm like, oh, this is the most important. Like, these teams are all fucked if these guys aren't making it back. And in Zion and Jimmy's case, at least, it seems like they are definitely not making it back, not just for their final play-in games, but for the next few weeks, which means they're donezo, even if they make it to the playoffs. So,
and in Kawhi's case with the Clippers, like, that's a team that's going to be in a dogfight of a series in a 4-5 matchup, even if Kawhi is in the lineup. Like, round three of Clippers-Mavs in the playoffs, except with the Mavs now having probably the best team they've had in out of those three, that's going to be a dogfight with Kawhi in the lineup. So yet another season that looked like it was so promising for the Clippers and that everything was finally coming together is looking like it's going to get derailed because Kawhi Leonard's body just won't cooperate.
Yeah, and I just want to point out what I thought was a really good article by Tom Haberstroh. I just thought it was a great way to frame. There's nothing definitive about this right now, and I'm not somebody who's going to be able to like parse through the medical data and come to any conclusion about this. But he was just writing about how we may be seeing some of the consequences now of the player participation policy. And the NBA released this study or like shared information about this study that it conducted kind of around midseason showing no strong correlation between load management and reducing injuries. And as Tom Haberstroh pointed out in that piece, since that study or the findings of that study were revealed, what we have seen is a bunch of star players getting injured. And it's like the whole point of load management was to rest players during the regular season so that they could be healthy in the playoffs. And so having a regular season where stars played more frequently, which they did, he in that article demonstrated that by the NBA's definition of what a star is, which is like a player who made all-star or all-NBA in the last three seasons, like that's how the player participation policy defines it. They had played 75% of their team's games last year, and they played 85% of their team's games this year. But what does that matter if those stars are now dropping like flies when the games are supposed to matter the most? And there, like, stuff is exempt from this, right? Like Jimmy Butler's freak injury is not like, you don't want to draw a correlation between that and, you know, playing too much during the regular season.
That was because Kelly Oubre tried to do karate in midair.
Yeah, but then you look at the Giannis thing, right? Where his Achilles had been barking for a while and he tried to play through it, and then he suffered a calf injury in the same leg, in the same kinetic chain, potentially as a result of that. Like Tyrese Halliburton thing, where he was playing through a hamstring injury, like almost transparently saying that he was doing so in order to meet the 65-game minimum threshold. And, like Jamal Murray, who hilariously doesn't even meet the criteria as a star under like the definition of the player participation policy because he's never made an all-star team. He missed a bunch of time down the stretch. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander missed a bunch of time down the stretch. Like Kawhi, who like we talked about a couple times now, like, yeah, it's amazing that he's playing in all these games, but
maybe we're starting to see him wear down as a result of that. And now here we are where we don't know if he's going to play or be anything close to 100% in the playoffs. So I think it's just important to be able to take a big picture view of this stuff and say, yeah, ostensibly this policy worked in terms of getting stars to suit up for more games in the regular season. But is that really what we want if it's coming at the cost of them being healthy for the playoffs, which was the express purpose of these load management programs in the first place? I've said it 100 times. I'm all for having players play more or a higher proportion of regular season games. And the way to do that has been very obvious to me and I think you for a long time. But that is not the road that the league or seemingly its players want to go down. And as a result, we're having to create solutions to a different kind of problem than the one that's actually staring us all in the face.
Yeah, the league's never short. They're never going to the perfect schedule that I created for them. That's only 58 games where everyone plays home and away, soccer style, and play every team twice and the regular season. We're never going to that. It's an 82-game season. That is Riz. And listen, I'm taking nothing away from that Haberstroh piece. And as you know, as our listeners are like, I've railed against the 65-game minimum all season, especially when the new anti-resting rules were then later put in place. I said, this is like makes the whole 65-game minimum thing absurd because now you've already put in rules that should curb resting of players that don't need it and aren't hurt. So why do you also have this minimum? So again, taking nothing away from that and taking nothing away from the possibility that it has indirectly led to or directly led to increased star injuries going to the playoffs. The one that sticks out to me for sure, no arguments, is what happened with Tyrese Halliburton this season. However, having said that, and not at all to carry water for the NBA, but we do have to acknowledge that last year, when these rules were not in place, Giannis Antetokounmpo got injured in the playoffs.
Yep. Kawhi.
Kawhi Leonard is Kawhi Leonard. Unfortunately, like he's been dealing with issues in his legs for, God, what, 7 years? Like 6, 7 years now?
Yep.
Zion Williamson, again, who I'm going to get into, unfortunately, like the guy's soft tissues are made of minced meat. So we could look back to even a year ago around this time and find a lot of these similar injuries with similar players before these rules were in place. So I do think we have to acknowledge that. Now, in terms of Zion, so you wrote the Warriors postmortem this week. The same night I wrote about Zion Williamson and the Pelicans. First of all, it's obviously not funny, but we did joke last episode or 2 episodes ago about how the Pelicans, the 2023-2024 Pelicans, were my reverse Godfather 3. And if you don't remember or you weren't listening to that episode, the whole point was shout out Alex Wong, friend of the show, who had coined that term, at least it was the first time I had heard it used, about the 2023 Blue Jays, where instead of the whole, you know, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. It's the reverse that it's actually just when I think I'm in, they pull me back out. And that's what this year's Pelicans were to me. Every time I started to believe or started thinking, okay, you know what? This team might actually have something. There was like a puzzling result or an injury crept up or something to always make me disbelieve. And wow, what a way for it to happen again. Like they roar back from 18 down after Zion kept them within arm's reach all night. And then they lose Zion on the game tying bucket. He's out for at least a couple of weeks with a hamstring injury. But it's just crazy to me how close he and the Pelicans got to exercising their demons in the game against the Lakers, only for them to suffer the same damn setback again. Like, the Lakers are their boogeyman in so many ways. If you want to go back to the AD trade itself, LA is now 13-6 against the Pelicans since that. Davis, although he didn't in the play-in game, and that's part of why it seemed like they were exercising their demons, he often feasts against them. And even this season, like forget the big picture for a moment. The low point of New Orleans' season this year was losing by 44 points to the Lakers in the in-season tournament semifinals, with Zion taking 8 shots in 26 minutes. And then all the usual Zion stuff came after it, right? Like most people who barely acknowledged the Pelicans at all to start the year were very quick and happy to bask in their humiliation after that loss. And Zion was obviously the easiest target because of his history. Chuck and Shaq, obviously his loudest critics over the years, ripped him post-game that night. Christian Clark, who covers the Pelicans, wrote the next morning, reported that the Pelicans have reportedly stressed to Williamson that his diet and conditioning need to improve, but Williamson, quote-unquote, doesn't listen. And then to top it all off, you had Stephen A. Smith, days after saying Williamson, quote-unquote, looks fat, adding that New Orleans area chefs love the big man because, quote unquote, the word out on Williamson is that he'll eat the table. All that happened within like hours and days after that humiliating loss to the Lakers in the in-season tournament. But then Zion on the Pelicans responded with four mostly excellent months of basketball. He mostly stayed healthy. He hit the 70 game mark for the first time in his career. The Pels were legit awesome for about three quarters of the season. Checked a lot of the boxes of a contender when you look at their numbers. And yes, sure, a spring slide that coincided with Brandon Ingram being sidelined relegated them to play-in territory in another matchup with those damn Lakers. But if ever there was a year they were going to slay their boogeyman, this was it. And through 45 minutes, it really looked like it could be it. Zion had friggin' 40 points on 17 of 27 shooting, 11 rebounds, 5 assists. He literally accounted for half of the Pelicans' points, 53 of 106, between his scoring and playmaking. This was it. Redemption was at hand. What should have been his signature moment, one that would have had even his loudest critics eating crow, instead somehow still ends up with, after the game, back on TNT, just like 4 months ago, Shaq saying he should have been pushing through the pain. Like, even when it seemed like everything had lined up for them to finally slay these demons, and for Zion himself to have this moment, like, we come full circle and we're right back to, no, actually, the story is that his body doesn't hold up, the Pelicans can't win with him, and people are questioning his body, his durability, his force of will, his pain tolerance, like all this stuff. It's just crazy to me that like we're right back here again.
Yeah, just especially because of everything leading up to it, right? Like I think, and again, this is something we've talked about on this show before and something that I've written about. It certainly seems like Zion embraced a lower impact style of play in service of keeping his body in working order. Like, you don't see that many mid-air collisions with Zion. Like, he does not really dunk that much. He doesn't, like, you'll see, like, in transition, right? Like, he will throw down alley-oops. He had that one play in the play-in game when he spun out of a post-up on Austin Reeves and caught a lob from, I can't even remember who threw it, actually, but basically, he used to do that all the time. If you remember when Lonzo was with the Pelicans, Lonzo would throw those like half-court alley-oops with Zion spinning out of the post-ups. Like, he'll do stuff like that, but he's not like colliding with people and dunking on people very often. Like, what he is doing is using his extraordinary touch around the basket to evade defenders rather than trying to go right through them. And I think that like that lower impact style of play contributed to him playing a career high 70 games this year and peaking at the right time, finally playing in his first ever postseason game, not a proper playoff game, but a postseason game, and absolutely showing out, going up against a defensive player of the year candidate. And I know Anthony Davis is not playing at 100%, but just scoring at the rim over AD with ease, dragging the Pelicans back from, how many were they? They were down like, what, 19 points? Dragging them all the way back, tying that game. And then after all of that, man, after the four injury-cursed years where all we ever got were these like glimpses of how brilliant he could be, because he would hit these high highs and then he would get injured. And then when he came back, his conditioning would not be nearly where it had to be because he's suffering all these lower body injuries, right? It's really hard to keep your conditioning up, especially when it's a lower body injury and you have to be off your feet. So he would have all these setbacks and he would slowly, slowly, slowly ramp back up until finally we got a glimpse of peak Zion again, and then he would get injured again. And just like the cycle repeating itself over and over and over again until finally this year, it felt like we were getting somewhere. He had a fully healthy season. And then, like, I can't get over how consequential that final game between them and the Lakers was. They lose a chance at getting a top six seed, which would have avoided them having to be in the play-in in the first place. And what Zion could have still gotten hurt in a playoff game, but like, they didn't necessarily need to be playing in this game to begin with, right? That leads to them getting bumped out of the top six, and Phoenix, instead of having to go through the play-in and then face like a really difficult matchup against, you know, potentially a Denver or an OKC, gets, you know, maybe the most favorable matchup for them in the first round while not having to go through the play-in. And at, you know, the Pelicans are where they are, where, like, what a gift for the Kings this is. The Pelicans are 5-0 against them this season. And now they're going into that matchup without Zion. And like I said, they could still win, but it's probably probably advantage Kings. So it's just brutal, man. Like, it's just brutal that after all that, not only like the style of play that he embraced, but according to Brian Windhorst, Zion lost 25 pounds this season following that embarrassing defeat that you alluded to against the Lakers in the in-season tournament. So he did everything he had to do, seemingly, to keep his body in peak condition. And again, to hit his highest high at the right time, and was absolutely doing it on the biggest stage he's ever played on. And then on a seemingly innocuous play where, again, he didn't like collide with anybody midair. You know, this wasn't like an audacious dunk where he landed badly. It was a soft little teardrop that he hit over AD, and somehow it fucked up his hamstring anyway. Just devastating.
Yeah, it's a damn shame, man. Like, I don't know what else to say about it. He's not going to get back this year. Like, even if the Pelicans win today, he's out for a couple weeks. He's probably out for the first round. They're not friggin' beating OKC without him. Like, yeah, damn shame. And I guess we'll just have to see what the fallout is from this latest setback in his career and the Pelicans' Zion era. But I think we can leave all that there and come back and talk about the 6 playoff series that are already set. What's up, Pound the Rock listeners? Just a friendly reminder to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also check out the Score's Fantasy Football podcast with Justin Boone. And in case you haven't already, download the Score app, available on iPhone and Android. That's where you can find all of our featured content, as well as live scores, updates, and breaking news. And don't forget to check out the Score's YouTube page for an informative yet lighthearted dive into the sports world's trending topics. Now back to the show. All right, well, Fond, to tee up the first round, we decided we're not going to do like full series previews that are going to take too long. But what we wanted to do is just quickly touch on each of the 6 series that are set. And so we said, why don't we do a thing where it's like for every series, each one of us takes no more than 2 minutes to talk about it, so that we guarantee for the 6 series, no more than 4 minutes each, 24 minutes total. I think we can do that. In fact, I know we can do that because we're going to set a timer and we better stay within that damn time. There might be some series where, who knows, maybe one person says a lot about the other person thinking. We might don't even have to get into it too much. But before we get to all of that, because they're the one seed, they're not part of one of these 6 series, but there was just a note I wanted to include about them. So, like, I'm not sure if you read my whole Anatomy of a Champion piece yet this season. I hope you didn't, because there's a bit of trivia I have for you that would be spoiled if you already read it. But the 2023-24 Celtics became the 10th team in NBA history to finish top 2 in both offensive and defensive rating. Now, over the last 48 years, they're only the 5th team to do so. Of the previous 4, 3 won the championship. The 72-win Bulls in 1995-96, the 2014-15 Warriors, and the 2016-17 Warriors in KD's first year. Can you tell me or guess who the lone team to finish top 2 on both ends over the last 48 years and not win the title was?
Was it last year's Boston Celtics?
It was last year's Boston Celtics. And so, again, we're not going to get into them because they don't have a first-round opponent yet. But I did just want to share that because it's like they had just this ridiculously dominant season that even for the storied Boston Celtics, you can make the argument was the most dominant regular season in their history when you look at compared to their peers that season. But at the same time, you don't actually have to look that far back to find a pretty dominant Celtics team that kind of fell flat in the playoffs. And I just thought that was a fascinating statistic that even though you might have already known it, I hope it's a fun little tidbit for our listeners before we get to the rest of the first round here.
It is an extremely fun tidbit, but definitely worth noting that in spite of the comparable rankings, they have almost double the net rating this year that they had last year. So still kind of leagues ahead. And I think even just anecdotally kind of looking at their roster construction and the way that they're able to play at both ends of the floor compared to what they were last year, it's a different team. And I wouldn't read too much into their past playoff failures as a result of that. So
100%. They finished 7 games clear of anyone else in the standings with a 5th best point differential of all time and the 4th largest gap between the top 2 teams in net rating. So yeah, agreed with you.
Yeah.
All right, let's get to those series. You tell me, okay, where do you want to start? And who's got the timer going?
I'm gonna roll the timer. So I'm giving myself 2 minutes to start. And okay, basically what I did is I just picked out one aspect of each of these series that I thought was the most interesting.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm going to hit on. There's obviously any number of different directions either of us can go, but we're trying to keep it brief.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give myself 2 minutes and then I'm going to kick it over to you. And I want to start with Mavs Clippers.
Okay.
So 2 minutes on the clock. Most interesting thing for me, I mean, obviously it's the Kawhi thing, but that's too obvious. So I'm just saying generally, how are the Clippers going to guard Luka? And when it comes to pick and roll, like, are we going to see Zubac in a drop? Are we going to see him at the level and they're putting 2 on the ball, which is a very dangerous coverage to play against Luka Doncic, but so is that drop coverage because of what he can do as a driver, somebody who can hit floaters, somebody who can disguise lobs. And I think what we've seen them do a lot in the past is just switch Zubac in that matchup. I've talked before about how, like, Luka's counter to that usually is just to go to the step back 3. Can the Clippers live with that? He's kind of torched Zubac in like those switching matchups in the past, but a lot of it has been just by hitting step back 3s. Can you live with that given how good Luka has gotten at hitting those shots? Then on top of that is, like, with the Kawhi thing, is he physically able to handle that matchup at all, let alone for extended stretches? And if so, how early do the Clippers go to that one-on-one matchup? Because I definitely don't think they're starting that way. At what point do we see them actually go to that look? And if they're not, are they doing some cross-matching with Kawhi where they're putting him on the Mavs center the way that they used to put him on Kristaps Porzingis in this matchup? And the Mavs' answer to that in the past was, hey, we'll just have Porzingis stand over here on the 3-point line. Kawhi's going to have to follow him out there. And then we're just taking, like, the Clippers' best defender out of the play. Kind of a different story with, like, Derek Lively or Daniel Gafford, who, like, they aren't spacers. So will the Clippers do that? Maybe stash Zubac on, like, a Josh Green or a Derek Jones Jr. or a Dante Exum, and then have Kawhi on, like, a Lively or Gafford and switch the Luka pick and rolls with those guys? That's the big question I have.
Okay, luckily you touched on most of what I wanted to talk about. I obviously had Kawhi's health as number one and whether he had the legs to potentially match up with Luka in a long, grueling series. And I also had Ivica Zubac's utility in this series as a big component of it. So you covered all that. What I will say then off the top of my head, in addition to that, is what I'm interested to see, and it's not so much of a matchup thing with Dallas and the Clippers, but more so just, like, again, if I wrote that piece that I do every year, the anatomy of a contender, where I would look at the statistical profiles of past champions and see which teams this year fit the bill. Well, the post-deadline version of the Mavericks, obviously in a smaller sample size, would have checked every single one of those boxes. And so a big question for me is it possible that adding Daniel Gafford and PJ Washington to this team was enough to put them over the top and get them over the hump? Obviously, the answer to that is, well, when Luka Doncic is playing out of his mind the way he is, you don't need as much to put you over the top as the average team does. But I am very curious to see how much of that kind of championship-level play carries over to the playoffs when it's time to actually go win one now, or at least try to come close to one. So very fascinated to see just how the Mavs look in the playoffs, because again, the post-deadline version of this team with Gafford and Washington was really damn good.
Okay, why don't you pick the next series?
Okay, let's go to Knicks-Sixers. Again, similar to Clippers-Mavs, obviously we can say the number one thing is just how healthy Joel Embiid is, the same way we were asking with Kawhi Leonard. The Sixers went 31-8 with Joel Embiid in the lineup, which is a 65-win pace, included an 11-7 mark against winning teams, 12-3 road record, and an average point differential of plus 10.3. Everyone's talking about his conditioning during that game against the Heat. I'm sorry, he came back more than 2 weeks ago and has now played 30-plus minutes in 5 of 7 games. If he's not up to par conditioning-wise, that's an Embiid problem. But if anything is wrong, it's the knee itself, which would obviously be concerning. And he didn't look quite right versus the Heat. But I will say, the playmaking and the quicker decision-making we saw this year with Embiid in Nick Nurse's system, it did carry over to that play-in game where I thought the passes and the decision-making was quicker, sharper, snappier when facing pressure. And if Joel Embiid is close to 100% health-wise, conditioning-wise, and that playmaking and decision-making under pressure does carry over, this could be the year we'll find finally for them. A lot of ifs in there. I understand that. And again, his health is the most important. But like, there's a path there.
Not to the conference finals, to be clear. Right.
The conference finals. Like, I'm not saying I believe in it, but there is a path there.
Yeah. So for me, the thing I'm most interested in is just OG Anunoby's defensive role. In the couple matchups that these teams played when OG was a Nick, he was the primary on Tyrese Maxey. And he is the rare kind of big, bulky wing who can actually handle that type of assignment against one of the quickest, maybe the single quickest guard in the NBA. So I think we will see him start out as the primary on Maxey. But like, his ability to defend either Maxey or Embiid makes him the kind of skeleton key that's going to unlock all kinds of defensive alignments, I think, for the Knicks. So like, they can have him be the primary on Maxey, but like, switch onto Embiid when they're running the Maxey Embiid two-man game. And then, you know, the question becomes, okay, well, like, Hartenstein or Mitchell Robinson, like, can those guys hold up on switching on switches against Maxey? Or is there somewhere that those guys can be stashed in like a cross-matching scenario that they're comfortable with? You know, like a Batum who had the game of his life in the play-in against Miami, and maybe you don't want to make that the guy who you're giving open threes to, but like maybe an Oubre, maybe even a Kyle Lowry potentially. Like, will we see them get creative with those kinds of matchups? It's not really Thibodeau's style. He will like typically want his guys to just sort of like stay solid in their matchups, but I'm very curious to see, like, specifically with OG, how his defensive versatility can impact the way that they guard the Sixers, and specifically the Maxey and Embiid two-man game. Because, you know, it's conceivable that he could be the primary on Embiid as well, and yep, then have that option available for him to switch onto Maxey, but they can go either way with that.
Where are we going next?
Okay, Wolves, Suns.
Ooh, this I'm is looking going at... to be a goddamn barn burner. Sorry, I've taken up 8 of your 100.
Yeah, what are you doing, man? That's 8 valuable seconds I can't get back. What I'm looking at in this matchup is Minnesota's interior defense versus Phoenix's disinterest in scoring at the rim.
Nice.
And I mean, like, there's all kinds of stuff that we could talk about in terms of just like how this matchup favors the Suns and is like not a great one for Minnesota. Like, the Suns won all 3 regular season matchups, made it really tough on Minnesota's 2 big lineups, just like a core part of their identity that suddenly they might have to lean away from. But specifically for me, it's like, you know, Minnesota's defense is great on the perimeter and the interior, but really what they specialize in is like preventing teams from getting to the rim and doing an amazing job of contesting shots at the rim when they do happen. So against a Suns team that doesn't really make getting to the rim a core part of their offensive objectives, what does that mean? Like, does that mean that it favors the Suns because the thing that the Wolves are best at taking away isn't something that they're trying to get to anyway? Or does it mean that the Suns will now get to the rim and score at the rim so infrequently and become so jump shot dependent that the Wolves' math advantage can kind of carry the day, even though they might struggle at points to keep up with all the perimeter talent on the Suns? That's the biggest question and point of intrigue for me in this series.
Okay, I'll bring up how the Suns plan to guard the Wolves in terms of matchups and how potentially the Wolves going away from the 2 big lineup, that is their starting lineup.
Okay, sorry, you took 8 seconds of my time. I want to take 8 seconds of yours. If they're going 1 big, to me, primarily Gobert is the 1 big that they are going to want to have. Like, he's the most mobile of those 3 bigs. Yeah. So
and deters those attempts at the rim, as you discussed. But in general, like, even when I think about how they're going to match up with Ant, right? It's like, okay, well, Nurk on Gobert, is KD on Cat? Do they put, like, I don't think they're going to want KD on Ant, right? And have him guarding the team's best player for the majority of the series. So, okay, you have a KD on Cat, but then... Yeah.
Could be Royce O'Neal on Cat.
Put Royce O'Neal on Cat, but then
KD,
what about
on McDaniels?
Okay, and again, who's guarding Anthony Edwards? Grayson Allen?
I mean, Devin Booker, Grayson Allen, Bradley Beal.
Yeah, I just don't think they have a very good option to do that. And I'd say, especially if the Wolves go smaller and there are like less options to match up, I just think, while I agree with you that I can see why this might be a good matchup for Phoenix, I also think when you think about it in like a playoff setting and having to guard a guy like Ant for, you know, 4 to 7 games, and I look at the way Phoenix is constructed, I'm like, listen, I like Royce O'Neal. I love the season Grayson Allen is having. I do not think like Allen has the size to do it. And then if he can't do it, like, again, you want Devin Booker having to try to guard Anthony Edwards? No. Can Bradley Beal? Obviously Bradley Beal can't do it. Like, I just start to think about it and I'm like, I don't know how the Suns are going to guard Anthony Edwards.
Yeah, I think now that I'm thinking about it, probably it's Royce O'Neal on Ant and KD on Cat. And I think that's pretty survivable for them. I could also see them getting a little bit more creative with it and putting like a Bradley Beal on Cat and testing out, especially with Cat coming back from that injury. It's like, okay, like run your offense through Cat then, and let's see how that goes for you. Like, I would honestly kind of be on board with them challenging the Wolves in that way and seeing what comes of it. So I think, look, we're not making picks on this episode. I think I would lean toward picking Minnesota in this series, but just because I think they're a better team. But in terms of like matchup specifics, I do think the advantages tilt a little bit toward Phoenix. All right, you're picking our next one. Where are we going?
We're going Bucks Pacers, and the big question here is, again, okay, fine, Giannis' health, as we've said now with so many of these series, but even if Giannis is healthy, I think like a big thing for me is, how much does Indiana's regular season success against the Bucks matter? Like, is there anything about this particular matchup that's so tough for Milwaukee, even with Giannis? But I do think it could come back to just like the simple thing of like, is it just that Indiana's high octane, constantly pushing offense is too much for a Bucks team that, as you have noted throughout this season, and I think even a little bit last year, might just be a little creaky and not athletic enough. And so while I understand why sometimes you can say, no, the regular season matchup doesn't matter. Sure, the Pacers beat them 4-5, but come on, they've got no chance against this Bucks team in a playoff series. It's like, well, if that's the reason why the regular season matchup was so difficult for Milwaukee, then absolutely that can translate to the playoffs. And it doesn't mean they'll beat them with Giannis in the lineup, but I think this is a much trickier matchup for the Bucks, even at full strength, than people are giving it credit for.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the big question that I had was the Bucks' improved transition defense getting put to the test, right? They went from being, I think, dead last in transition frequency allowed before Doc Rivers took over to being like, I think, 10th or 11th after he took over. So that really gets stress tested against a Pacers team that, obviously, no pun intended, loves to push that pace and get up and down the floor and is gonna put them through the ringer in that regard. So that was a big question I had. And then secondary to that, just kind of, you know, which of these backcourts is going to get more exposed defensively? Because, you know, when the Pacers have the ball, it's like, I think, you know, Beasley is going to be guarding Halliburton. How well can he get around screens and navigate that in sort of the pick and roll game? I think, like, with, you'll have Dame, I imagine, hiding on Nembhard, right? So can Nembhard do enough offensively to sort of make Dame uncomfortable in that matchup? Because it's like, if the Pacers want to do the mismatch hunting thing where they're working like the inverted pick and roll game with Siakam, they'd rather have Halliburton as a screener in those actions because of his threat level as a shooter who can kind of like ghost out and be a threat as a movement shooter in those sort of two-man actions. But Nembhard doesn't bring that same threat level, but also you probably would rather bring Dame into the screening action than Beasley. So how do the Pacers attack that? And then obviously at the other end, if Giannis is healthy, like, how often do we see the Bucks do this? Because we haven't seen a lot of inverted pick and roll between Giannis and Dame this year. Like, do they amp that up in an effort to kind of attack the Pacers' smaller backcourt? Curious to see what that looks like and which one of these backcourts can hold up defensively for longer.
I'll just add 15 quick seconds here, just because I think it's funny to point out. If you remember, it was a few months ago, whenever the last of these Pacers wins against the Bucks in the regular season was, and you know, there was all the drama all year, right? The game ball thing, everything. If you remember, it was Malik Beasley who said something along the lines of like, oh, like we'll get them in the playoffs or want to see them in the playoffs. And we joked at the time, being like, Malik Beasley, you're the kind of guy actually that usually somehow finds himself out of a rotation in the playoffs, and you might not have a say in it. Now, obviously, he's still in their rotation to start the playoffs, but it is hilarious that we enter the playoffs and he's at least already lost his starting spot if nothing changes. So I did just want to point out how that has actually come to fruition the exact way we envisioned it when he first said he couldn't wait to see the Pacers in the playoffs.
Yeah, and I'll add another like 20 seconds and just say, in a lot of those regular season matchups, the types of guys who were guarding Giannis one-on-one, and this was a part of the season where the Pacers were like more help averse than I think they were by the end of the season. But they would be leaving like Buddy Hield or Benedict Mathurin on an island against Giannis, staying home on everybody else. And I think we're going to see a different. I mean, again, this is contingent on Giannis even playing, which is the biggest if by far in the series. But like,
and he's reportedly doubtful to start the series. Just so we're clear.
To start the series, yeah. And Nesmith did get like probably like the biggest crack at it in those regular season matchups. So it's not like it was Hield or Mathurin all the time. But now having more defensive infrastructure, more defensive weapons potentially to throw at Giannis, like how much Siakam on Giannis do we see? How much of a difference is there in terms of their coverage plan against him? Because in spite of the Pacers dominating this regular season series, Giannis got off in pretty much all of those games. So, okay. I guess we will go Nuggets Lakers. Gotcha. I feel the Cavs Magic is a really interesting series to me, so I feel bad drafting it last here. But Nuggets Lakers, Jokic's pick and roll coverages against the Lakers ball handlers, and I think specifically D'Angelo Russell, because in this series last year, we saw Jokic in drop a lot. Whereas like the series before against Phoenix, he'd been up at the level on almost every pick and roll. That is the coverage that he seems to be most comfortable with, that he executes most. But against guys like Russell, guys like Reeves, who were deemed to be not like dangerous enough pull-up threats to pull him out of drop, he was basically able to hang back, and the Nuggets got away with that. So I'm kind of wondering if Russell can sustain his three-point shooting from the second half of the season, does that become a non-starter for Denver to play drop against him? And if Russell can start getting two on the ball and the Lakers can get the ball swinging out of that and, you know, have LeBron or AD attacking a tilted defense from the second side, can they have a lot more offensive success in this series than they did last? We talked about how their offense had this complete turnaround midseason this year, and they were one of the best offensive teams in the second half. So can they put more of a hurting on that Denver defense this time around than they did last year when they frankly weren't able to make that much of a dent? And you know, Russell, as we've mentioned a bunch of times, eventually got played out of that series last year because his offense was not good enough to justify keeping him on the floor when the Nuggets were continually exploiting him at the other end. And it just feels like once again he's going to have an outsized importance in this series. So I'm going to be watching how the Nuggets are deploying Jokic as a pick and roll defender.
All right, maybe it doesn't apply so much to this series specifically, but something I'm watching with the Nuggets early on in the playoffs and seeing how it develops as they go forward, trying to repeat, is, look, I know the playoffs are more about your top players, and I get that rotations are shortened, but you still need some depth to go forward. I'm really curious to see how the Nuggets kind of revamped bench compared to last season performs as the playoffs go on. Like, Reggie Jackson had a much bigger role off the bench during the season than he had last year, obviously. Peyton Watson is going to factor into their playoff rotation when he didn't really last year. Christian Brown has a bigger role than he did. Justin Holiday. Can these guys give the Nuggets enough in high leverage postseason minutes, even in small postseason bench samples, to get the Nuggets where they need to go to kind of just hold the tide for that awesome starting lineup? And specifically, can that Aaron Gordon at center bench look with this new revamped bench from this season, like, have the success it had in last playoffs? I feel like it can and it should, just all things considered, but I think it's worth monitoring.
Yeah, I feel like we're going to see a not insignificant amount of Peyton Watson guarding LeBron James in this series, and I'm very excited for that. Peyton Watson's like straight up one of the most fun defenders in the league to watch right now.
You want me to take us home here with Cavs Magic?
Take us home.
All right. I get that a young team that struggles to create quality offense seems like the exact type of team tailor-made to take their lumps and learn their postseason lessons. And I'm obviously talking about Orlando. But even put aside the fact that the Cavs are a reeling team for the moment, which they are, am I crazy? Or is there something about Orlando's kind of grinded out defensive identity that almost makes me think they could be better suited for the playoffs? And like, even that tough to watch offense, which by the way, finished 22nd. So they ended up finishing bottom 10 in offensive efficiency for a 12th straight season. But is it possible that Paolo Banchero, Franz Wagner, like the type of creation they have, even though the offense looked ugly and didn't perform well, but the type of shot creation they have and their ability to create from areas that the Cavs and good defenses will concede actually makes it possible they might be better suited to the playoffs? Or am I crazy? And I'm just like grasping at straws here, trying to find a way where this like grinded out team who can get shots off from the mid-range can survive in a playoff series against this Cavs team.
I don't think you're crazy to suggest that it's possible, but it's not the way that I'm thinking about this matchup. Like, if I'm comparing, right, like, I think some people might point to what the Knicks were able to do against the Cavs last year as this big physical team that just sort of overwhelmed them with size, and the Cavs couldn't score at all in that series. And, like, the Cavs are going to have a hard time scoring in the series. If I'm making a comparison, I think this Magic team is much more reminiscent of that 2021 Knicks team that got blasted out of the first round by the Hawks than they are to last year's Knicks, because it's similar in terms of like where they get their shot creation from, the fact that they lack a quality lead guard. And going into that series, I think a lot of people were saying like, this is just a bigger, more physical, tougher team than the Hawks, and people picked them to win for that reason. And then yeah, they just like couldn't create enough offense at all, and they got run out of their own building by a team that was able to get quality looks way easier than they were. And like, the Cavs are a good defensive team as well, so it's not like, I just don't think it's going to be very easy to create offense for Orlando in this series. And you know, so my big question actually is like, how many offensive oriented players can the Cavs get away with playing in this series? Like, can somebody like a Sam Merrill make a big impact in this series? Because Orlando isn't the type of team that can exploit defensive weak links like him. And will that allow Cleveland to open up the floor a little bit more and get their mediocre offense out of the mud? You know, like, more broadly, I guess, how often are they going to play, and especially close games with only one of their bigs on the floor? You know, and like guys like Sam Merrill and George Niang and Caris LeVert, like, can those guys factor into some of those lineups that are more offensively tilted, and the Cavs can still survive defensively because the Magic just don't really have enough juice to hurt them at the other end of the floor? So those things, and then just like specifically the Donovan Mitchell versus Jalen Suggs matchup, I think is going to be all kinds of fun. And we've talked about how much Cleveland is relying on Mitchell to be Mitchell in order to advance. So that's going to be a big pivot point for sure.
Dude, watching Jalen Suggs compete on any given possession on a Wednesday night in January is inspiring. I can't wait to watch this dude get his first taste of playoff action.
Yeah, I'm honestly like, that individual matchup is one, like, top five for me in terms of what I'm looking forward to watching.
All right, Wolfman, we did it. We did it, Joe.
Man, I'm really proud of us. We actually made that work. And I think we was like, you know, maybe it wasn't like thorough, but I think we got into some interesting tactical stuff anyway.
No, I think it was great. And I think, again, as the playoffs march on, and especially as we get to later rounds, like by the time we're in the conference semis, there's only four series to talk about. We'll be able to kind of dive into series in much more detail from a preview perspective later on in the playoffs. And even when we come back next week, we'll be able to dive into more detail about each matchup based on what is actually happening on the court, as opposed to throwing out these hypotheticals or what could happen. So we look forward to that. Wolfo, you got anything else to add on this fine Friday afternoon?
Apart from a fan shout out, I do not.
Oh, hit us.
Okay, so Spotify commenter Austin Stahl hit us up. I didn't say where he's listening from, But he says he found PTR during COVID and has been a big fan ever since. Also, made a bet with an LBJ hater before the 2020 playoffs that he would win two more rings as a starter. You know, Ball. How do we like my odds, PTR? Not
he's
well.
He's got to win one more.
He's got to win one more as a starter, though.
Yeah.
I don't love those odds.
If you're asking strictly for the odds, almost like probabilities, yeah, I'd say definitely less than 50%. Like, even if things were trending right, it would be tough to give a guy a 50% or a better chance to win another championship. It's hard to do it. So at this stage of his career, the state the Lakers are in, you know, I'm going to say unlikely, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, who knows? The Lakers make one move this summer, come back with kind of one more kick at the can with this. Like, it's
Well, I'm saying if it does happen, I don't think it's happening with the Lakers. That's kind of...
Yeah, that's also a fair thing to say. Yeah. Again, you're asking me for the odds. They're not great, but they're not impossible.
But they're not zero.
Yeah. Such is the power of one LeBron James, who is doing it still at 39 in year 21.
Yeah. So, okay. On top of that, I had just a quick follow-up shout-out to our SoundCloud commenter and pal Kid Kills Me, who commented on our last episode to say, I let the Luka slander slide. The Luka slander being that I said he was third by a hair in MVP voting behind Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Nikola Jokic. That constitutes slander, apparently. He will let that slide. I mean, how much do Toronto fans know about MVPs anyway? But he said he still loves the show. So thanks, Kid Kills Me. And fair point. But you know, we know enough about finals MVPs, I suppose, because we saw, I remember actually, like, so the 2020 season, when the Clippers were visiting the Raptors and Kawhi got his championship ring, we were all huddled around, like, waiting for Kawhi to come do his post game availability. And he made us wait a very, very long time.
I remember that.
And, as he's walking through, the Clippers PR person, I can't remember who it was now, but was like, make way for the MVP.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, finals MVP. I don't know if we can go around calling him the MVP, but. There you go. That's what we know about MVPs in Toronto. Kid Kills Me. Thanks for listening, pal.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Don't like your comment. All right. Now we good? How can we get out of here? Let people bask in the weekend and the beginning of the NBA playoffs?
Yeah, man. Let's marinate in this first weekend of playoff ball. I'm excited.
Love marinating. All right. We'll talk to you next week when we will have actual playoff basketball to talk about. Until then, for Joel Wolfon, I'm Joseph Cacciaro. Pound the rock.